if the unthought matter is that being is presence, but time complicates the idea that being is presence, then fine. I'm cool with that. I get that. And I feel like I got that before I even opened this book. Right. Like, yeah. But if, I mean, if it's anything other than that, I don't understand what it is. You know, like, so time is passing away, which is to say presence is always a residual effect of a passing away. It's never simply there. Got it.
Right.
Right. Got it 10 years ago.
Yeah.
You know. And by the way, got it from Heidegger, right? I'm not dissing Heidegger in that regard, but I'm just wondering, am I missing something else, or is this just the sort of being is constituted by its coming to be passing awayness? It is never, you know, simply present. I mean, he never says that. Like, he never says it can't be simply present because it's passing away, which I was waiting for a sentence that was just that, because it's not like a hard thing to say.
Yeah. Right? I mean, he does allude, like, he says stuff similar maybe in the previous section where he says time is by being what it is not, you know, which just, it's a kind of a cute turn of phrase, but it points to what you're saying. Like, the essence of time is that it doesn't have an essence, or that it doesn't have a structure or being, you know? So if it's, if it's just that relational, I mean, yeah, you're right. I think it's just the sort of relational, you can't even call it a grounds of being that is the unthought of metaphysics.
And I guess I just feel like that's, I mean, again, I just feel like that's what being as presence is always coming to be passing away. Again, I learned it from Heidegger.
Right.
So it's not, I mean, I'm basically like criticizing Heidegger for not being Heidegger, which is absurd.
Yeah.
You know, you know, it's like,
or just kind of glossing his own theory, you know, not in an interesting way. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But for instance, I mean, things like, for instance, the whole notion of the past here, he doesn't say like, look, the past is being thought as a present that's just past, right? Like, you know, that's the thing that I was waiting for, is that the notion of the past as that frozen entity, you know, is something that is behind me now, is taking the past as a present that's just not actual anymore, you know? And that's the way, I mean, to me, that was just that he says, you know, like, when we think of presence, the presence is the moment of the now, the past is what's behind us, and the past is in the future is what's before us. But I'm like, no, I mean, I think the past is very clearly thought as a presence, right? Like, it's not the present tense, it's not the present moment, but the past is conceived as a presence that's just not here anymore, right?
Well, he gets at that in two places and in two ways, right? I mean, the first is when he turns to Aristotle and Augustine and tries to even see that in their work, where it's like, look, the past isn't a non-presence, it's just not a present presence. And so, like, it is and it isn't, you know, in the Latin of Augustine on page 102. So that's the one thing, is that he's suggesting that even within this tradition, there is a way of thinking about the past as not simply lacking presence. It just doesn't somehow have the fullness, and then you suddenly get into the great chain of being stuff. But the other passage of thinking about the past as something that's not simply past and alien is through the eternal return of the same itself. And so, but part of the move there, and he has to go through Schelling to make it, is that if we're going to think about being not in terms of, you know, substance, but in terms of will, then the eternal return of the same as it capable of thinking of and orient itself to the past completely differently.
Right. It would be really interesting for me, because what strikes me immediately is the extent to which Heidegger's version of the eternal return really relies on it being the eternal return of the same. Like, it has to be the return of the same. It can't be the Deleuzian selection of difference, because it's the only way that you can will eternally is to have the same thing occur eternally.
Except that I think there's a fundamental difference between the eternal return of the same in that kind of cosmological, like the scientific sense that we talked about it over the last couple of episodes, where the return of the same or the return of particular substances, identities, events, whatever else they might be. But if you're going to swap out an ontology of substance for an ontology based in will, then it's not the return. It's not like the same thing is going to happen at some point again in the future, or the same identity or the same substance will coalesce at some point in the future. It's that the singularity of a past of a moment can be willed eternally.
Could it also mean that the same structure of willing eternally returns, like in the figure of revenge, etc., like so that the will wills itself in the same way eternally?
Here's how I understand it. The past, the existence of the past is a problem for the will because it's a limit case. It's something the will can't do anything with. Again, conceived of as something that is simply past and behind us.
And I would add there that that's also a problem for the future insofar as you think of the future as a future set of having pasts. Right, because it doesn't matter. This is his stuff. Like he's like, look, science isn't giving us any more time. It's giving us less time in its capacity to measure smaller and smaller units of time. As soon as you're dividing up time in terms of units of has passed, will pass, doesn't matter. It's become that calcified thing that, you know, the will doesn't have control over anymore, or will not have control over anymore.
So as I understand it, the goal of the will is eternal, and the only way the will fulfills that goal is to will itself eternally. And it can't will itself when it's limited by the it was, whether we think that in terms of an obvious past or Nathaniel's amendment to think of the future in that way. He's starting with a very chunked up ontology that's then going to proceed, as I understand it, to kind of blur the chunking, so that you wouldn't have a sort of distinct past, you know, present, future thing.
Yeah.
That you have. So, you know, what the revenge is the result of the will encountering this limit. So it only thinks in terms of representational thinking, right? So revenge is manifested in representational thinking as a product, as a result of the will encountering this limit. What's required for the crossing over, the bridge or crossing over, is to get rid of revenge.
Right.
And Nietzsche's way of getting rid of revenge is the thought of that eternal return, which in Zarathustra, it's really, really clear, like, you know, Zarathustra struggles with this, the black snake that goes down his throat, right? Like the spirit of revenge that he kind of can't get hold of or has difficulty with in the eternal return, because does the eternal return mean the eternal return of everything exactly as it is, which would seem to be the total limiting of the will,
mm-hmm.
right? Or conversely, does it mean, you know, opening up possibilities of the past to the kind of the sense of futurity or active willing that the will sees in something like the future.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's just,
that's how I get it.
The language is just, the Deleuzian version of the eternal return makes so much more sense to me, in that it would be the eternal return of a movement of differentiation or of difference.
Right.
That makes total sense to me. The eternal return of the same, if you were to think of it under a Hegelian comportment, it would be the return of the will of revenge, right? That kind of appropriative force. But that's also not what Heidegger's after here either. So it's just the word same, to me, it's difficult to wrap my head around how that enables the overman in this context, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's the eternal enduring of the past as an object of will,
not as something that is simply past.
Right.
Correct. I mean, so I think he gets at this the full paragraph on 104 that is going to help us think through this the most. The last sentence of the first paragraph says that deliverance from revenge is the will's liberation from what it is revolting, from what is revolting to it, so that the will can only, so that the will can at last be will. And so this is, I mean, I think this is, there's the liberation is the allowance of the will to be will rather than the will to be representation or the will to focus on representation. It's that next paragraph where he complicates that. At what point is that it was removed, which is always revolting to the will? Not when there is no longer any passing away at all. For us men, time cannot be removed. But what is revolting to the will fades away when the past does not freeze in the mere it was, to confront willing in fixed rigidity.
When the past becomes something other than simply has passed or it's gone in that rigid hypostasis, size sense of past moments, past subjects, past whatever. What is revolting vanishes when the passing is not just a letting pass in which the past sinks away into the mere it was. The will becomes free from what revolts it when it becomes free as will, that is free for the going in the passing away. But the kind of going that does not get away from the will but comes back, bringing back what is gone. The will becomes free from its revulsion against time, against time's mere past, when it steadily wills the going and coming. This going and coming back of everything. It is a making, not a, making a present of the past, but making an eternal of the past as will.
Right. An eternal transformability of the past as much as the future. The past is not simply the frozen thing behind you. It's something that's going to transform. So that's the idea of the return of the same then is, I mean, you could say that's the hook to Deleuze's version. Right.
Well, I this is where I think Deleuze and Heidegger diverge a little bit, is that I don't think, you know, I wrote in the margins, you know, the Faulkner quote, you know, the past is not dead. It's not, the past is not even past, you know, which like tends to have some kind of connotation of, as you were saying, John, that the past isn't fixed. The past is constantly being transformed in relationship to the present, and the past is constantly transforming the present in relationship to itself as a kind of specter or something that works on the present. And, you know, there's that hook that I think you're trying to make to Deleuze, which would be like, that would be a version of the eternal return of difference, where the past is constantly doing the work of differentiating the present and always in a transformative way.
It's, and vice versa, like the past, present is differentiating and remaking the past. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. I don't think that's what's going on here. I think that there is a stronger sense of the sameness here, of the eternal willing of the past, the eternal affirmation of the past, not as past, but as eternally willed will. And I don't know if that transformative sense is still operative, or if the or if there is a transformative sense that's just operating differently.
It would be so much easier if we had a more dialectical version, meaning like if we didn't talk about the will and we were able to talk about wills. I mean, that's what Deleuze does, is active force and reactive force, affirmation and negation, and you put those two different things together and you get like a, you know, eight different possibilities of, you know, reacting negation or acting negation or whatever.
It just seems like the word "the same" is just reductive in a way that it doesn't have. Like, it could be the eternal return of the will, or the eternal. It could just be the eternal return without "of the same." Why do you need that preposition? Why do you need that clause in there? Like,
I sort of see, but if I think about it a little harder, it's harder, because my initial thought was what Nathaniel is saying, which is like he needs it to be the eternal return of the same, because that's the only way that the will can will eternally, is because the past is no longer simply behind you. It's still to come, right? In a way, it's not the future, but the past, because it's eternally recurring, it's not just behind you. So that puts it in front of you. if you're the will, and the you here is the will, right? Like it puts the past in front of you as the eternally returns. So the same must be the same in order for the will to take it as its object. And it must have the hope that the will, that the past won't simply stay frozen, but will recur, right? But right. but that really does require it to be the same.
Right.
You know,
well, there are two.
If I say same twice, does that make it?
Yeah, you fixed it.
Do two sames make a different? I mean, there are two things operative here. I mean, one is, you know, I don't think it's. I think it's with great care that he turns to Augustine and sort of sets up Augustine's orientation to time. And it's important to the important note there is that the eternal is not. In time. It's not like, you know, the eternal isn't forever in time. The eternal operates outside of the movements of time. And, you know, the eternal becomes very much so caught up in God for Augustine, who operates, you know, not forever in time, but operates independent of time. And so for the eternal return of the will to become eternal is to treat it as if it's not operative in time at all. How do you make the past not operative in time? And for him, I think that's the second move, is to think of the same, not in terms of the traditional notion of substance, but, you know, if this is an ontology, like the basic ontological unit here, as he's pulling it from Schelling, is will. Right? Not substance, not identity, not some content or thing. So the same would have to be, it would be the eternal return of the same would be the eternal, not in time, but sort of like the a timeless affirmation of a will.
Right. And this,
which then substantially or phenomenologically, maybe that looks like, maybe it looks like it's the same all the time, or maybe it's perpetually differentiating and transforming.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know, man. It's
I don't either. I also feel like the sort of, I mean, you know, look, the way that it's presented here is at this point as a kind of crossing over from the metaphysical view to something else. And that something else seems to me like, you've got two different versions. So, for instance, to me, like one of the things that I hesitate around is when he goes, for us men, I mean, you just read this passage, for us men, time cannot be removed. And I'm like, wait, what? Didn't you just tell us it didn't drop from the sky? And aren't you involved in attempting to rethink it? Like, I guess I felt like in reading this, I was just a little bit torn. Like, I'm just unclear what Heidegger sees himself as offering, right? Like,
right.
Maybe the problem here is that he has offered so much that I have read in other arenas that I am not cognizant of him as offering these things, like via him or Derrida's version thereof, right? Like, but
well, I mean, this is tangential, but it kind of points to why, like, maybe nobody really treats temporality as the center of their ontology these days, right? Like, time is not like the main focus of any contemporary theorist. It's like some version of relations. Even for Derrida, difference is temporal, but it's not, he's not always talking about time, you know? And I feel like just the difficulty of thinking it and articulating both an ethics and an ontology out of specifically thinking temporality is so weird and difficult that it makes it hard to latch on to anything.
For example, to me, it's not, this thought is not a difficult one for me. The idea that the past, I mean, the Faulkner quote, like the idea that the past is transforming just as much as tomorrow, right? Like, that's not a difficult thought, that the past isn't simply a given, that it is always being, in my terminology, performatively, you know, repeated, differentially performatively repeated, right? Like, so that's not hard. So I can say, like, look, of course, here's the problem is, if you see the past as frozen, the present as present, and the future as we don't yet know, that seems like an overly schematic, you know, coarse way of thinking of this. That if instead you say there is no such thing as the present, there is simply the movement of present seeing, and the past is its own kind of transformative vehicle, and the future is another kind of transformative vehicle. That makes sense to me. Like, I don't find that to be a terribly hard now, but I also sort of take that to be what I've just described to be the metaphysical version that he's talking about, which is like, it's all sort of perpetual transfer, regulated, of course. Like, it's not simply like everything goes, but I mean, transformative. You have coming to be, passing away of the past, present, and future. Mm-hmm. Right? They all are subject to the sort of self-transformational, or in our terminology, we'd say like self-differentiating, simply because they're never identical to themselves, right? Like, I mean, so I don't know. For me, that doesn't seem like a terribly hard thought, and it's
no.
It certainly is different from the notion of the frozen, the present, the empty future, you know, from that image of time.
But what you just articulated, that's still relatively complex. I mean, just to say that time, that all the tenses fold into one another, you know, in certain ways and affect one another, and they aren't simply present or frozen. I mean, what Heidegger's saying that I think makes it another step of difficulty is that the metaphysical orientation reacts against those dynamics. So like that vulgar notion of a linear notion of time, you know, is precisely a reaction. That's that revenge against time that we get in the will. So it's like, and he's saying that we don't get out of that really. So
isn't the second version that I articulate, that's what I understand linear time to be.
Yeah.
You know, like maybe I have done something wrong, because I feel like that version, it's recursive.
Yeah.
Right. Like, in other words, there is still a sort of remaking of the past as one moves into the future, but it's still going this way. Right. The engine of recursion and rearticulation are still all going toward, from a past toward a future. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that's, to me, that sort of recursive notion, I feel like. And again, maybe I'm just not giving that thought enough credit, and maybe that thought is the interesting one that he's pointing towards. I genuinely don't know.
You know, what matters here, I think, is how Dasein thinks its own being and thinks its own relationship to being. And so there is like that spirit of revenge, that will of revenge and revulsion against time, is a major problem. And so it would seem to me that in either versions of those times, certainly the coarse version of, you know, simple past, simple present, simple future, is a major problem for, you know, the spirit of revenge, and the major problem of, you know, the stagnation of the man and the prevention of the bridge to the Overman. That second one, that second version, doesn't seem to necessarily lead itself to, you know, it doesn't seem like the eternal return of the same is just an ontological given, like it is, like the eternal return of difference is for Deleuze. It seems like this is much more an object of affirmation that could or could not lead to a particular kind of transformation for the human, this particular kind of deliverance. And so in some ways, he's like articulating a line of hope for the human and the transformation of the humans. Like, it sucks to be operative within a world of representations and the revenge. I mean, like, representations might do a whole lot for us in terms of their capacity to conceptualize the world and sort of logistically contend with the world, but only through an engine that produces revenge and resentment as a kind of a byproduct. And the only way out of that mode of being is to re-articulate our relationship to the past as something that can be affirmed eternally.
Yeah.
And so it is like that's what I take the most. I mean, this is what I have never seen from Heidegger anywhere else. You know, not just the ontology of being and time, but a kind of
almost like an ethical or like an orientation to something like futurity vis-a-vis the eternal return. And this is the first version of the eternal return of the same that I find interesting and provocative.
Yeah, I agree.
Still, I still prefer the Deleuzian way, but like this is at least different. That's
what, I'm sort of wondering if you follow this out, if you don't get to that, that's my sort of underlying suspicion. I don't know. I mean, let me walk through that for a second. So for instance, when I say this recursive version that I take to be the linear version of time, the reason I take it to be the linear version of time is I feel like the recursion that's happening is more of a relationship to history than it is to time itself, right? Which is like, yes, history, our version of the past, and so far as it constitutes us, is constantly up for grabs. Like, that just strikes me as obvious, right? Like, I mean, I'm not saying that everyone believes that. I'm just saying that doesn't seem like a hard point to make, which is our understanding of our past, it's not so much the past, it's our histories, that reconfigures who we are today and who we will be, and that's sort of transformative. That strikes me, again, to me, that's a recursive relationship to time that's much more of a relationship to history than it is to time itself, right? Time itself still is a past, present, and future in a very kind of straightforward way, even if one has a recursive relationship to the historical things that occur in time.
But so that would be a kind of, that wouldn't be an ontological perspectivalism. That would be an epistemological perspectivalism that would say, like, all right, time as pastness has, you know, is an objective set of relationships. And then epistemologically, narratologically, whatever, we tell different stories right. about it. And those stories affect how we're capable of living within the mm-hmm. moment. And those stories are constantly up for grabs in terms of their interpretation and construction right. and deployment. Right. But that, I don't think, would get at this more, I think, underlying transition from thinking about ontology in terms of will.
Yeah. Well, right. But so if you took the next step and you simply said, okay, what one is doing when one recreates history is remaking time. Right. Like if you said it's not simply like history isn't just a narrative laid on top of time. Right. It is itself in time, so that in rewriting histories or reconceptualizing or whatever else, one is in fact remaking the folding of time itself, right? So that it's not like there is an underlying linearity that on top of it, you know, one has this social construction mm-hmm. of history and consciousness at whatever.
Which is, you would then have to say that history doesn't have a privileged relationship to remaking time. It's just one style of...
Oh, for sure.
Attention
for sure.
Time,
yeah, right? I would yeah. have no problem with that. So so I guess the next step is your sense of the recursive quality of that. I mean, does that give you the eternal return, which is that every moment is, because I mean, if he's reading it here, is in a sense he's sort of saying Nietzsche's version of the eternal return of the same is that the same, or is that the past will always again be present. Right, like
if you're assuming a metaphysics of substance where there are discrete entities that have been passed that will come again in the future. But I don't think that's, I think the, so, you know, I think recurrence is a problem because we think of that very iteratively yeah. or like serially, where there's like, here's a dot, here's a dot, here's a dot, here's a dot. And all those dots are the same, but they're just on different points on the same timeline, right? The introduction of the concept of eternal here removes you from that line. They're not dots. It's like the same thing is affirmed eternally. So it's not dot, 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 dot. It's a single straight line yes. or a beam. It's a hum rather than a staccato.
So in a sense, yeah. Eternal is a bad word there then for the eternal return. It would eternal seems to me, I mean, it doesn't necessarily, but it seems to me that it occurs at every moment in time is how we think of eternity, right? And it sounds like what you're saying is atemporal, yes. the atemporal return of the same.
Yes, but this is why that word eternity is important for Heidegger, because eternity, at least if you follow like the a metaphysics of time stemming from at least Augustine, eternity has nothing to do with time. In fact, what marks the eternal as eternal is that operates outside of time.
Right. Well, it's also maybe a reason why it's not the eternal return of the similar, right? I mean, it's like it has to be the same, right? Because it's an essential relatedness, you know, that transcends any kind of contextual temporal relation. This is a structure of being, right, that persists, yeah, always. John, you're saying, like, thinking of it in terms of history is relatively easy, at least in within these theoretical configurations that we're used to. The problem for me, is that there's always that cosmological sense too, or like a quantum physics sense, which I just don't have any grasp on, or like I don't have a way to orient myself. And it always lends towards a kind of thing in itself type of thinking, right? Where it's like, how do we think of time as this thing that's just out there as a physical entity that's so complex that we simply cannot get a hold on? And I think that's not really what Nietzsche's after exactly either. I mean, there is that cosmological version of the eternal return of the same, but I just don't really know what to do with that one either.
Can you explain to me what you think is so cool about the Augustine quote? Because, I mean, I don't see, like, nothing of what is past will be called back. What is of the future is expected as something that will pass by. That just strikes me as like, the past is frozen, the future will come and pass away.
But that's all within time. That's the less important one. It's when, and I need to find the passage. Well, I'm going to start here at the first full paragraph on 102. Since in all metaphysics, from the beginning of Western thought, being means being present, being, if it is to be thought of in the highest instance, must be thought as pure presence, that is, in the presence that persists, the abiding present in the steadily standing now. Medieval thought speaks of nunc stan, but that is the interpretation of the nature of eternity. Here, let us recall for a moment the explanation of Schelling adds to the statement, willing is primal being. He says that among the predicates of primal being, there are eternity, independence of time. If all metaphysics think of being as eternity and independence of time, it means precisely this. The idea of beings sees them as in their being independent of time. The idea of time sees time in the sense of a passing away. What must pass away cannot be the ground of the eternal. So that's that distinction of the separation of the eternal as not being a part of the temporality of a passing away. Not just a duration in time that is so long that it never actually passes away.
So this is in a sense of the eternal as an eternal present, then. If all metaphysics thinks of being as eternity and independent of time, it means precisely this. The idea of beings see them as in their being and independent of time. The idea of time sees time in the sense of passing away. So it's an eternal presence, right? It's God.
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly what Augustine does with God.
But it's not, I mean, that the point would be it's not a, I mean, if you continue in the passage, it's a critique of that, right? Like, it's like, that's the view of presence, right? So, you know, but what about that definition here left unintended of being itself as being present, even as the enduring presence? What about being as the being presence in whose light time was conceived as a passing away and even eternity as the present now? Is not this definition of being ruled by the view of presence? The presence ruled, that is, by the view of time and of a time of such a nature as we can never surmise, let alone think, with the help of a traditional time concept. In other words, it's like that notion of atemporality that constitutes that understanding of eternity ain't the one he's interested in. That's the problem, like, is that eternity thought as eternal presence. Because, I mean, you know, so it continues on to the gloss of being in time. It's like, what about being in time then? Must not one as much as the other being as much as time? Must not both become questionable in their relatedness? And does this not show then that something was left unthought at the very core of the definition which is regarded? So in some ways, I feel like what he's critiquing there, the notion of being as presence or eternity or atemporality thought as absolute constant presence, right? Like, which I guess I just was like, well, we're not dealing with that because, you know, to me, that's just like, who fucking thinks of eternity as constant presence? But obviously Augustine did, or others in a certain theological tradition.
Yeah, I mean, this is where I just really go to Deleuze's version of the eternal return as well, because the eternity here then, especially I'm on, I don't mean to jump somewhere if you're staying on a page, Nathaniel, but on 104 towards the bottom, you know, he's talking about the will wills its own eternity and the will wills the it was. I mean, to me, it's like you are willing differentiation then. Eternity there is the will's perpetual dissolution, and the way to get rid of the revenge or the revulsion against time is transforming the will's relation to itself. So willing eternity in that sense means basically an affirmation of becoming,
right?
Yeah. I mean, in Deleuze's sense, in exactly that sense.
That's what I'm saying. I feel like it heads in that direction. It doesn't spell out the steps. You're right. But I mean, that to me, I agree with you, Boo Boo. That's like, that seems to me to be where it has to be headed.
Yeah. And I mean, we touched on this last episode, so I'm not going to bring up spirit extensively here. But I mean, in the same way, he brings up Hegel in the previous section where he's talking about the will as a torn consciousness, right? So like in order for the will to kind of approximate its own conditions of actualization and affirm those, it has to affirm the tearing, the cutting, the rift that's essential to being, right? So as opposed to that eternal presence or of a compulsion towards identity, which is the traditional, the will of revenge, the will to eternity or the eternal return of the same has to will perpetual dissolution.
It doesn't have to be, dissolution, but rearticulation, iteration or something else.
Right. Yeah. The quality of that movement doesn't have to be,
but it has to be
described
moved.
As
right.
Yeah. It can't be self-identity, which is what people are after. I think experientially, that's what he's saying about the traditional will's identity against difference.
So, I mean, and maybe I get that idea, and like that makes more sense. That makes sense to me. I think partly, like last night, I taught signature and context in my grad class last night, and I was just struck by like it. Maybe I've just been reading Derrida for too long, but like how amazingly obvious it is that of course a mark is never present, right? Like who would be stupid enough to think that a word is simply present, as in right there? Now, obviously, a lot of consequences of my claim there follow that aren't often followed out by people. You know, so the consequences of non-presence of a word aren't often followed up. But nevertheless, that fact strikes me as kind of inarguable. Like, of course, right. I mean, it wouldn't work if it was simply present. It has to come from somewhere else and be able to go somewhere else. Like, it has to, in other words, it has to be structurally non-present in order for it to work. And that just strikes, like I'm saying, like, it just seems kind of obvious. Again, the implications and ramifications of that may not be obvious, but that fact strikes me as obvious. And so I feel like I'm starting from a point of non-self-presence, you know? And it's like he's working up to a point of non-self-presence. And maybe that's the problem, is that, like, you know, I have been reading Derrida for too long, and I'm like, okay, I got it. Like, non-self-presence. You don't have to go through all the moves in order to get there. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, one of the issues is that it's a problematic rather than a problem to be resolved, right? So like the will to revenge or whatever, or resentment, is a constitutive dynamic for Heidegger, right? It's the relation to being is just as much about concealment as it is about disclosure, right? So there's that perpetual movement of concealment and disclosure. And so inherent in our relation to our relationality is a reaction against is a kind of like reactionary disposition. And I think that's the same for Derrida. So that's what makes it difficult for me to see like the absolute transformation via the figure of the Overman or Derrida uses like joy or humor or sometimes or any of that is because it seems like if it's a constitutive dynamic,
there's
then
no
there's not really an alternative. There's ways that you can ponder it and reflect on it, but
but that's why, I mean, so for instance, that's an example of why I like the version of the Overman in Deleuze, which is it's just the word for futurity, which of course means the past as well, right? Like that's right. that's who the Overman is not a figure. You know, it's
It's
always a place marker. And the goal is never to become the Overman, but to give birth to it, to prepare the conditions, to do the thing, you know. So it's like, I think there's just a textual justification for reading it that way as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm starting, I reacted, you remember when you taught Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Zarathustra, what was it like almost two years ago? It was before the pandemic. And that was like the last class I took. I was reacting so harshly against the notion of the Overman because of all this like latent Hegelianism that I didn't even know I had in me. So I was just like, why would this concept doesn't make any sense to me? It seems too almost utopian. But now through these different lenses, I'm like, it's actually a pretty cool concept. I mean, I like the way that it's like navigated via Nietzsche, even in Foucault, this through Heidegger as well. I mean, it's a useful thing to try to articulate because it's so difficult.
Right. It gives the notion of a bridge and a direction without a goal. I mean, that's, you know, if you think of it that way, like that's, you know, so it's not aimless, but it doesn't have a telos. And, you know, that's a tricky thing to conceptualize or to even write. Did you work through it, Nathaniel? Nathaniel figured out why his...
Yeah.
what happened in that eternal thing?
I think that you're right, that there's definitely a critique of a traditional notion of time in those passages. But I'm not sure that the critique is moving in the direction that as you laid it out, is that, yes, there is a problem in thinking of time simply in terms of presences, and you can't root. I mean, I think he's pretty clear that, look, I can't fix a version of time from the perspective of being, and I can't root as perspective of a sense of being from the perspective of time, that they are completely intermingled. And it's like, hey, if you know, if you want to learn more about this, read my book called Being in Time. But I don't think that he's simply dismissing then the notion of the eternal as something that operates not quite according to the logic of a passing away. And you know, when he turns to the eternal return, which like I think it's important that the word eternal is in that phrase. You know, this is toward the bottom of 104, and we already read part of it, but we're talking about the deliverance of the will from its revulsion against time. So this is like, 14 lines down in that second full paragraph. The will becomes free. The will becomes free from its revulsion against time, against time's mere past, when it steadily wills the going and coming, this going and coming back of everything. And that seems to support what you're saying, John. In fact, that sentence right there sounds the most like there's a current transformative differential aspect of it. But then you keep going. The will becomes free from what is revolting in the it was, when it wills the constant recurrence of every it was. The will is delivered from the revulsion when it wills the constant recurrence of the same. Then the will wills the eternity of what is willed. The will wills its own eternity. Will is primal being. The highest product of primal being is eternity. The primal being of beings is the will and the eternal recurrent willing of the eternal recurrence of the same. The eternal recurrence of the same is the supreme triumph of metaphysics of the will that eternally wills its own willing. I'm still getting this sense of a revaluation of the past and the revaluation of all metaphysics in terms of wills. And let's just think about like the will is nothing more than the direction and force of a becoming that has more or less affinities with some things than it does.
I mean, it's desire, desire for
desire. Yeah, desire and the delusions.
Desire that produces consciousness. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Desires that produce a consciousness as an effect. Exactly. But anyway, that it would have to be a continued, in many ways, atemporal affirmation of will as primary being. That can never have just passed away, that doesn't operate in the passing away of presences, which is why this is the deliverance of revenge, of revulsion.
Yeah, but how is that not? I mean, because, so for instance, like, it, to me, the direction that the Augustine quote was going is, say, you know, like, Augustine desires a sense of eternity that is atemporal because it is in a constant state of presence. To me, Heidegger's intervention here is saying there is no constant state of presence, right? It is only coming to be, passing away. And so the will's willing, the desire of the will to be eternal, is to will the capacity of the transformation of the past just as much as the transformation of the future. So that's where...
Okay, so that opens something up for me right there. You're totally right about Augustine, is that because the eternal is more or less conflated with God, and God is sort of like this unifying presence. Self-presence that then becomes the source for the
all the becoming of the world is a fallen version of God's total absolute self-presence.
But you're right. Yeah, I mean, that's completely the case. But I still think, and I think he's problematizing that notion of the eternal as pure presence identical to God. Right. But I think he's holding on to a sense of the eternal as something that doesn't operate according to a logic of temporal passing away.
But it's temporal presence. I think it does operate as passing away, but not a presence that has passed away. It is nothing but passing away, right? Like, if you remove presence from that equation of coming to be, right, passing away, you remove the middle point, which is the present, right? Instead of, so, because to me, what's happening in this line of thinking is that we're kind of hypostasizing presence and making it the absolute transcendent term. And instead, I think what he's doing is extracting it out and saying it's all coming to be passing away. And so if you think of the will only in terms of those things and never in terms of a presence, then it doesn't encounter the past as a limit anymore. Right, because it's the past is not
a presence. It would have to be So passing away would have to be made eternal.
Right, coming to be passing away, becoming. I mean, that's what, you know, Boo Boo was saying a little bit ago. Like, becoming is everything. Like, if it's all becoming, then the affirmation of being. I mean, again, we'd have to be careful because becoming only has meaning in relationship to a certain understanding of being. Right. So you'd have to, you know, but you'd call it difference, right? Or you'd call it iterability, or you'd call it desire, or whatever else. That what we're talking about is removing that notion of presence as the undergirding principle, not sort of transcendentalizing it to becoming this sort of absolute term of eternity, but separating it from, so that all presence is only constituted by the coming to be, passing away, or iteration, or difference, or, you know, whatever those terms are. So that allows the will.
Are you telling me that you two were continuing to have this conversation while I was deeply reading and pondering
We did. We actually, you're gonna have to go back and look, because we figured all this shit out. Like, we nailed it down. Like, Boo Boo, like, wrote the end to his dissertation. I mean, he's like, okay, I'm done. I'm done now. I wrapped up the style book. And
yeah.
How long was I out? What eternity?
You
did I
and
miss
your it? Time fixation on the present, man.
Yeah. It was both an eternity, and it was only 5 minutes. Yeah.
Oh no, this is not recorded time. You people and your reliance on technology. This is extra temporal, but not because it's a presence.
Can I move us in a slightly different? I mean, it's still the same question, but just in a slightly different milieu. I'm on 109 when he starts talking about the two subterfuges, or basically, I guess, misreadings of the eternal return. And he kind of suggests I might be also misreading Heidegger's exposition of these misreadings, but he seems to suggest that the eternal return not only as a concept, but also possibly as an ontological phenomenon, is historically located, that with Nietzsche's thinking and perhaps with the onset of industrialization, modernization, whatever, that that's when the eternal return came onto the scene. And I'm wondering what you guys think of that suggestion, because that kind of relates to a quasi-Foucauldian notion of, like, right, the break in the image of thinking and in the kind of being when you get to modernity. That for Heraclitus, not only was there not a concept of the eternal return of the same, that wasn't a phenomenon back then.
Well, that's why he puts Parmenides and Heraclitus next to each other, right? If Parmenides is the thinker of absolute being and Heraclitus is the thinker of absolute becoming, right? Like that's where the sort of link of those two, and that's why he's really interested in Parmenides, especially because it's like, hey, here's what absolute being is, total Heraclitus in that sense, you know? But I mean, this is just an aside before we get to that, because it's on the same page. I love that rereading that chunk from Zarathustra at the very top, where he's like, we've created the heaviest thought, which is the eternal return of the same. Now what we have to do is invent a being who can affirm that, right? Like, in other words, it ain't human, right? Like, the human came up with the thought, but we can't fucking affirm that thought because it's just too heavy, right? It means all the boredom, all the banality, all the tedium, all the everything also returns. Right. So we have to figure out something capable of selecting. But for the two objections, like, the second objection is easy, right? Like, the second objection is that, hey, we can find this thought. This is just the thought of a cycle. We can find this thought everywhere. Right. Right. And so there's nothing terribly new about this thought. And he's like, but, you know, and I agree with him on this. What good is it supposed to do us to ascertain that some thought can already be found in Leibniz or already in Plato if their thought is left in darkness as this thought is allegedly clarified by such references? Right. So in other words, it just becomes a way of degrading or denigrating a line of thinking without engaging it. You know, I mean, and so I get that part as well. It's like, you know, we still haven't thought, or here's a way, or maybe it's, here's a way of avoiding that thought, where he says the thought of the eternal recurrence remains veiled, right? And it's veiled in two ways. One of the ways is because people just say, oh, it reminds me of Leibniz. And again, that's not to say that it's not. I mean, it's just, but that doesn't necessarily go anywhere. It's very common. Right. Think about, to me, this is the whole new materialism indigenous critique. Right, like, is exactly that. Is like, oh, that was already done by indigenous people. And it's like, well, that's a way of avoiding the question, right? Like, that's a very, like, what is the thinking? Like, lay out the thinking. But that's not done, right? Because that's the work. That's the hard part. So that's the second one. The first one is Nietzsche's thought of the eternal return of the same is a kind of mysticism and doesn't belong. It's not properly philosophical because it's self-differentiation.
Yeah.
So as concerns the first subterfuge, according to which Nietzsche's thought, blah, 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 the coming age in which the essence of modern technology will come to light might have taught man that a thinker's essential thoughts do not become in any way less true simply because we fail to think them. I mean, so that's his way of saying, you know, again, that's just another way of dismissing. I mean, that's what I take it. That's another way of not thinking with the thinker, you know, is to say, well, that's just sort of a mystical thing that's not properly philosophical, which, frankly, I mean, think about how a lot of, you know, analytic philosophy engages or doesn't engage Nietzsche as being too literary, too poetic, right? I mean, to me, that's the equivalent there. It's like, this is not a rigorously philosophical concept. And he's like, yeah, that's fine, but that's just a way of avoiding engaging with the thinking, just like saying it has precursors. So to me, those are like two strategies or two tactics for not thinking with a thinker. Again, that I sort of agree with. Now, I also think in both cases, one can follow those out and one could think eternal return via Leibniz and one could think, you know, Nietzsche's eternal return through poetry or, you know, mysticism or whatever else, right? Like, one could do that.
It might be valuable to do so.
Right. I mean, it's true. He does, you know, very much link this to the coming age in which the essence of modern technology will come to light, right? Meaning it will reveal itself as the sort of the essence of modern technology as the, what, representational standing reserve, you know?
Right. Yeah. And he emphasizes somewhere back in the beginning that Nietzsche is not just an extraordinary thinker. He is, insofar as language speaks us, he is a vessel for a way of thinking that was enabled in that particular historical era.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So like the reason that Nietzsche is Nietzsche is because he was in that moment. Like if you put Nietzsche back in Heraclitus's time, it's no longer Nietzsche.
Right.
There's not the same thinking, not the same character of thought at all.
Right. But, I mean, that's the way, I mean, to me, that's the importance of thinking time, is thinking the sort of irreducible embeddedness in temporality that is not simply present. Right. Like that, like hanging on to both parts of that, the irreducible embeddedness in a moment and also the non-determinate quality of that moment. But I think, and especially since our reading recently, it's like Hegel can give you that, although it's too teleological in Hegel. But nevertheless, it can give you that sense
right.
of like, look, to be in a, you know, Plato wouldn't work without the pre-Socratics. Right. It wouldn't make sense without a certain precursor. And then Aristotle doesn't work without Plato and that, you know. So all of those relationships are absolutely necessary. I mean, I think all the time, just in terms of my own personal life, having nothing to do with the history of philosophy, it's like, I am so fucking thankful to live in a historical moment where Nietzsche wrote, Deleuze wrote, Derrida wrote. Like, I'm just like, what would my life be? It would be different, and I wouldn't know it as missing that. But given the one that I'm in, I'm so, like, truly, like, when I go to Thanksgiving dinner or something, I think, like, one of the things that I'm really thankful for is to have lived after these people wrote. You know, really.
Yeah. You know? I mean, could you imagine a John Mokelbauer that hasn't read those? Like, what would that person even be? I mean, it would be so...
I mean,
would it make sense to say he's still a John Mokelbauer?
It
wouldn't
make sense to me, not anymore. I mean, certainly... I mean, I've thought about this a lot recently as I'm getting older and whatnot. Like, you know... I didn't have to go this particular direction. It could have happened other ways. And to that extent, those things that I read even very early would have just been like, oh, you know, these childish things. You know how you create the narrative of your own development. But that's from a vantage point, which is like, okay, given who I am now, here are the things that were really formative at that time. But if it was a different who I am now, those things would be ancillary, secondary, and I may not even remember them, right? Like, it just could have gone in different ways. Like, I'm certain of that. I mean, I have no doubt whatsoever.
Isn't it weird how much comfort it gives people to think, like, oh, I was always destined to do this thing, or, you know, I couldn't imagine myself doing anything else? I mean, like, that to me is weird.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I kind of get the anxiety just because, you know, thinking that I could have broken in a different direction at, frankly, any moment in any part of my life, in any direction. Now, granted, some of those directions are more or less likely because, you know, the affinities are greater or stronger, right? But still, that there is in no way, shape, or form, like some essence of Nathaniel that is going to emerge. And for a lot of people, that's scary because it's sort of like the thing that I identify with the most is completely contingent, so much so that even myself isn't enough to hold
it all
together.
Don't you have, like, for instance, I would say for me now, meaning starting at age 52, I would say it now, like now I would say I feel much more of a sense of, I would never call it destiny, but like a calling. Like there's a thing that I'm meant to do, right? And of course that's because of a buildup of a whole lot of training and everything else. Like I don't think it's metaphysical in that way. I think it's simply like, given that I've spent 30-ish years doing this kind of thing, I now feel compelled to do this kind of thing, right? When I understand people's sense of that destiny thing, I think they just felt that earlier, right? Like the feeling that I have now of like, look, I'm not. And I'm way comfortable with this. I'm not going to be good at a lot of things. There's a lot of like, for instance, golf. I like playing golf, and I'm relatively good at it, and I work, I practice. But I simply do not care enough to practice enough to get really good at it. I just don't, right? And so, like, from this point on, I couldn't be a great golfer. I just couldn't. And the reason I couldn't is not because I don't have the physical, because I don't want to. right? It doesn't matter to me. Like, I want to write cool shit, and I want to produce interesting intellectual ecologies. I want to do that. So I feel called to do that kind of thing. I recognize that I feel called to do that kind of thing, not because God's speaking to me or something, but simply because I've been doing that kind of thing, and it's what I enjoy. I've found the source of joy. And I'm just saying, like, you know, I think for me, it was somewhere in my mid-40s where I started to feel like, okay, I'm doing what I should be doing, right? Like, I am in the right course, not because there was some preordained course, but because I was built into this kind of, you know, this type, these series of practices, and it found my place or whatever else. But I think that other people said,
your constitution
right,
emerged.
That's fine. But
right?
I think that other people have that when they're 16 years old, or they can have it when they're 16 years old, or eight, right? Like, so to me, it's no different, right? Like, it's, I mean, that's how I understand it, which is like, hey, I'm called to, in the sense that, like, I desire this more strongly than anything else. Like, I would rather be doing this thing than anything else. So, like, Tiger Woods with golf. I mean, to take the golf analogy, it's like everyone always understood is like, oh, his dad must have forced him to practice when he was a kid. That's completely untrue. It was exactly the opposite. This kid wanted to do that 24/7. His parents had to make him go to school and go to sleep. Like, and he's just had that insistent desire for that series of practices his whole life, right? Like, and that's, I mean, to me, that's how people end up being great at things, is because they figure out what that draw or drive or desire is when they're 12, 13, 14 years old, not when they're 45.
Right.
Well, but I think you would have to modify it and say it's not that they figure it out, it's that they coalesce in a particular way.
That's
right?
Fine.
It's not like it was always
that's
there
right.
And
you're,
I just
you're absolutely right.
It.
It's not simply like it was there and they finally became cognizant of it. Yeah. They got immersed in the series of practices and networks and ecologies that would formulate them to be that person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it just happens, sort of, like, and it turns into, not in a negative aspect, but a compulsion. You are compelled to do this thing regardless of your circumstances. You have to get it done. You have to do it every day.
It.